Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Gochner. I represent the Political Center, and I'm so excited to have on the political left Shireen Gourvani.
Hello, Natalie. Always great to be with you. And listeners, we're happy you stick with us and tune in.
And the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, good to be with you.
How do you define the right these days, John? I mean, it's a little fragmented, yes? I'll come to you in a minute, Shireen.
Yeah. I'm going to say it's fragmented. I would say you've got kind of your traditional Reagan Republican crowd. You've clearly got a big populist crowd, some would say the MAGA crowd, and then the MAGA crowd is splitting.
Yeah.
Those that are into nation building versus those that are adamantly opposed to nation building are going into wars. And so you're seeing a split
Isn't that something?
You're seeing those that are also kind of same lines going, we should buy ownership in companies and we shouldn't buy ownership in companies.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. So Shireen, I know of at least two splits on your side, but would you go deeper than that?
I would. I mean, I think we absolutely have a whole population of folks that are still with us in sort of that kind of Rust Belt working class. I would just say folks that maybe are a little disengaged from maybe some of the more hot button political, how to even describe it? Because I do think the biggest hot button issue for most Democrats is an economy that works for people in the middle class. And I think that really unites us. And that's across, you know, working parties, families, Democratic Socialists, moderate Democrats. We share that.
Yeah.
But then there are issues like, I mean, frankly, we saw in the last, you know, in the most recent primaries, things like Gaza really being a big issue. Things like transgender rights still continue to be difficult to navigate for the sort of big tent. But I think for us, we're really centrally focused on improving the lives of kind of everyday working Americans. Mm. We share that.
So any questions for me, since the middle is also something important?
How do you see the left and the right from your perspective?
Well, I think you guys captured
it. Sitting there on the fence.
No, yeah, you're good. I think you all captured it quite well. I would say that the extremism at this point, there's a bit of a reaction that's pushing more people to the middle. And so I think the middle's holding strong.
Yeah. And then I think the middle, to me, is an interesting place because there can be people who are sort of moderate in their politics. Mm-hmm. And then there can be issues that are largely shared support, right? And that's where I think about things like getting money out of politics, thinking about reducing the cost of healthcare. Like these kind of big issues pull a lot of people into the middle, I think.
And, I think one thing where there's probably some element of agreement between the parties is we're concerned with the cost of healthcare, housing, educational, and work opportunities. But we're significantly disagree generally about how to get there.
Yeah.
What policies should be put in place? And we see those disagreements in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Does the government need to be more actively involved in the economy, or do we want the government less actively involved?
Yeah.
And we have that debate.
So three quick things on the international stage, some geopolitics here. What? It's reportedly said that 80% of the U.S. missile interceptor capability has been used.
Yeah.
80%. That's alarming. That's enough to want to get out of this conflict.
Well, I'm going to say I don't know what the number is, but the key concern I have, and I've had this concern for years, is we have so weakened our supply chains to produce our armament and our weapons that you get into an issue like this. You go back just 2 years ago when I was campaigning and talking about Ukraine. It's like we're not supplying munitions at the rate, the missiles and so forth, at the rate we need to. And you can't spin up a supply chain overnight.
Shireen,
this is usually a multi-year effort.
We're not rearming fast enough.
Yeah. Okay. So this is, you know, truly the dream of sort of the military-industrial complex that controls a huge part of our government and our lives, unfortunately. I agree with you. I think that there's a real question around our long-term planning and the way that we invest in having the kind of munitions that are necessary. I think there's an even bigger question about the ways in which this administration has been pulling us into situations that we really do not need to be involved in, and the way that we arm particular people and not others that should be all on the table in this conversation.
I think the other thing is also what we need in the future is changing. You know, drones are becoming a bigger play. There's the question about aircraft carriers. How many do we need? How quickly will they get destroyed in any major conflict?
Yeah.
And do we want more ships rather than fewer larger ships.
Yeah. Economist magazine has this great cover. I think it says The Shape of War, and the letters are spelled with drones.
Yeah.
The New Shape of War, something like that. We've got Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, now publicly rejecting President Trump's 15-point Gaza peace plan. The plan had a full disarmament of Hamas before Israel withdraws, but Netanyahu wanted complete disarmament up front before any of this happens. This is a little unusual for Bibi to take public disagreement with our president. He needs President Trump.
Is it?
Well, I mean, they so come and they glad-hand each other.
Here's one of my questions. Is this just more for show? So he can say, hey, I fought for the best deal I could. So then when he agrees to something in the future, you know, he's okay and he maintains his credibility? Or is this truly a disagreement?
Yeah.
And I think it's more the former than the latter.
I think that presupposes that Netanyahu has support, which he doesn't. I mean, his support has been absolutely on the ropes and dwindling further.
And thus the hard line, so he doesn't lose any more.
Right. And I think at this point, unfortunately, we are not going to see a plan come to fruition. I think it's really important for our listeners to remember that as much as President Trump wants to tell people that these conflicts, whether it is Israel and Gaza or in Iran, they just continue. And he does not have a plan.
Got another one for you. This is still geopolitics because it took place in Turkey. But did you see the...
You didn't say what you thought about Netanyahu and his pushback.
I'm just still in mourning over October 7th. I think it was a tragedy for all involved. And I can't believe we're this far down the road and we haven't gotten to a better place. And I think Netanyahu should give it a skip and start supporting a peace plan. Okay, now back to Turkey. I don't know if you saw the footage, but now we know from Washington Post reporting the clear evidence that really happened that President Trump,
who's on which plane?
Yeah, President Trump was in Turkey, boarded Air Force One. They have footage now of the
new Air Force One.
Well, he didn't take
that's
that
right.
one.
He took the new Air Force One, but hopped on the old Air Force One.
Yes.
Then he went out a catering truck, you know, one of those trucks that goes up high and can feed equipment into the plane. He goes in one door and out the back. And then they fly Air Force One home using the call letters of Air Force One. Basically, all these people in it that are sitting ducks.
Yes.
While the president comes home on a Gulfstream or something. I thought this is like
wasn't this going to the UK? So it wasn't flying all the way. But yes, you're right. It's kind of this for safety reasons.
Yeah.
Now,
the Secret Service for taking care of our guy, and I think you have to do these kinds of things. But who knew?
Yeah.
Who knew that
it indicates
the new Air Force One was that unsafe and the old Air Force One wasn't even safe.
Right. I mean I think don't forget, right, that the new Air Force One is from the Qataris, right?
Yeah.
So this is unprecedented. It is deeply concerning that this is in the fleet at all, I think, should be.
Wow.
And I do think this is just sort of the fiasco of this presidency, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, you know, this, I think both the planes are safe to a certain extent, but there's always security risks.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was just an extra element of security.
Yeah. And I'm glad they took it. From the standpoint of, I want to see this president get to the end of his term. I mean, I don't want, you know, the alternative to that. So,
right. Yeah.
Hey, we also had July, the hottest month ever documented in the United States. Not a surprise to us here in Utah, because it's sure been hot out there. I spent this weekend up in the Tetons. It was hot up there. It was dry up there.
Yeah. I was in the wilderness in Idaho and genuinely have a kind of a terrible cough because of the smoke.
Yeah, you couldn't see the Tetons, you
no.
two.
Oh, wow.
I mean, they're kind of there, but you could make the outline, but I couldn't take my 2.5-year-old grandson, Jethro, and say, look at those mountains, because there
can't
was...
see them.
Yeah, you really can't. They're not defined enough in
there
the smoke.
There you go, Grandma.
Yeah. I think it's unfortunate that we are starting to very much live with the reality that this is probably the coolest summer that we've experienced. There's no reason to believe that next summer will be cooler or the next or the next.
Yeah, and I would say that there's reason to believe it because it's so variable, but the trend will not be
there.
It
will not be
there. Who knows? Todd Blanche. Let's talk about Todd Blanche for a minute. This is the former personal attorney to President Trump. He's got his confirmation.
The new attorney general, no longer acting.
Yeah. He's always impressed me as being a smart guy, very knowledgeable, well-spoken. I just hope he holds strong on some of the ideas that this president has that I don't support, like the weaponization fund.
Right, right. And one of the key things I think the Republicans that voted for him were of the opinion that he will do more help to caution Trump from some of his impulses, maybe not as much as others desire, but more than would have happened with potentially some other appointee as attorney general.
Well, that's interesting because he basically gave a retroactive pardon, not going to investigate, not going to look into Trump's Trump Inc., right? Trump's personal finances, no IRS investigations for Trump or his family.
In the past.
But captive
for the going forward issues.
I'll just say that we may also talk about vaccines today. We had Kennedy sit and say he would not change the schedule of vaccines, and he absolutely has changed the schedule of vaccines. I think we should believe that Todd Blanche will also absolutely do whatever this president asks.
Only 2 years left. Hey, let's take a short break, and then we've got a lot of other great topics to talk about. Natalie Gochner with John Dougal and Shereen Gurbani. Stay tuned, everyone.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shereen Gurbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
And Natalie Gochner in the political center. All right, you two, I want to talk about this federal judge that's now blocked the U.S. Postal Service from enforcing the Trump order on mail-in voting.
Yeah.
The judiciary just continues to be a foil or a check and a balance to this administration. This one...
Or a roadblock.
A roadblock, yeah.
Whatever it might be.
This one, struck me because our state has been such a leader in... the mail-in voting, and I think it's quite popular here.
Yeah, yes, it absolutely is. Isn't it over close to 90% of Utahns vote by mail?
I've just learned to really enjoy it.
Yes. Yeah,
I sit with my ballot. I think about it. I wait till the right moment to turn it in to make sure I haven't missed something.
Yes.
I can encourage my kids to turn theirs in. It just gives you this space to... participate in your democracy.
Well, and I think this is a place where we have a lot of shared.
Right. I was just going to talk about how I enjoyed standing in line, talking with friends and neighbors on election day. That was fun for me.
You still have the choice.
You still have the choice.
But the line ain't there anymore.
But I would just say all of this comes down to a place where I think actually all three of us really agree is that this is an issue not to be dictated by President Trump, but rather is an issue that's controlled by the states.
Yeah, it's first and foremost a state issue.
Yes.
And then Congress can weigh in time, place, and manner. And Congress has not weighed in on this. So to me, the president has no ability to go weigh in on this thing unless Congress has spoken.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, now we've got a Medicaid work requirement. Reporting is that it will leave. This is the local news, 40,000 Utahns without health care. Shereen and I, this is one where we've disagreed in the past. I tend to like work requirements. I want to get people...
Able-bodied people working.
Yeah. And we've got to do something to trim and fine-tune these entitlement programs. But your take on this,
Shereen.
Yeah,
so we continue to disagree. there are a lot of complications to the ways that this was rolled out, not particularly thoughtful or easy for folks who may be working in different kinds of economies. So gig economies, folks that are working temporary jobs, people that are getting paid to maybe do care support for another family member, right? There are lots of different kinds of work that happens that's really difficult to capture in these particular work requirements. So people may have found alternative ways to supplement their incomes. Folks that are living on the edge often do. Mm-hmm. And it's nearly impossible to capture that in these kinds of work requirements. So folks will ultimately lose care. And I think one of the things that's really important here is this kind of broader notion of the cliff, right? So you make a little bit, you make a little bit more. Have you made enough to actually get a job that provides health care? Well, maybe not. So you may have good reason to not want everything on the books and still be making significantly under what is poverty wages.
Because what you're describing is there's a certain window you're eligible. And if you make $1 more, you're ineligible and you lose it all. There's not like a slope. It's a cliff.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I've known people who won't take a pay raise because they don't want to.
Yeah, I know.
Or they'll quit a job.
It doesn't mean that 40,000 are going to lose their coverage. It means that 40,000 will lose it if they can't document, their work readiness.
Right. And the documentation process is not one that's easy. So the application process, last time I checked for Medicaid in the state, was already over 20 pages. Mm-hmm. That is difficult for a lot of folks. So to be able to even navigate the system as it exists now is specifically designed, I believe, in this state to keep people out.
And this is where Natalie and I probably disagree. I don't think these should be federal programs.
Oh, no, so I'm with you on that.
These should be state funded, state sets the rules rather than money from D.C., regulations from D.C., changing rules from D.C. I'd rather it's their state-run programs.
John, in typical Natalie John fashion, I'm with you to an extent.
Okay.
Because what I don't mind it being federally funded, all those sorts of things, I like the waiver process. You know, where states go into the federal government and say, here's why we can do it better, and then you can grant those waivers. When I worked at HHS, governors were always coming to make their case for waivers in these programs. And I like that because it allows you to fine-tune and do these things, but you still get some national consistency.
Yeah. You also get some really good experiments, right? So when you think about things like Medicaid paying for doulas or particular programs that are launched in different states, then you actually have like a really good, interesting comparison with a control group and an experiment group to see what really matters in terms of health outcomes for you, for Americans.
And states typically have to balance their budgets. So they have to make sure they can fund it versus the federal government who spends without money being there and we just grow the debt.
Let's jump to bear's ears, shall we?
Okay.
It's since I've been in bear country and all of that. So the issue is the Bear's Ears National Monument that was shrunk by more than 1.2 million acres under the Trump administration. This came with big applause in the White House, you know, with Utah's delegation, our governor and the like. One of the big justifications for it was that the larger Bear's Ears restricted recreational activity. And of course, as the news comes out, it's not true.
Yeah, it's not true. I guess, am I supposed to believe that Donald Trump's unaware that you can go hiking or fishing on a national monument? I just can't even imagine what it would look like to see him doing that.
Yeah. I've spent a lot of time in this area. I love this area of our state. I feel so badly that there's so much misinformation all the time going back and forth about what's happening to grazing, what's happening to recreation, what's happening to mineral development. Some people think that you shrink the size and that means it's just going to all be exploited. I don't believe that.
Or that it's privatized.
Yeah,
and it,
yeah.
And it's not.
And some people think
public,
you expand it and you get all these visitors, and maybe you do, but if you don't have funding to like take care of these visitors and do things, I mean,
you've now drawn attention and they're showing up.
Yeah, it's just a hard thing. But anything else you guys want to say about public lands and Bear's Ears?
I mean, so much to say. I do think a really interesting part of it, and maybe sometime we could have an expert come on and talk about, I think the grazing issue is a particularly interesting one and one that I learned a lot about when I was running in this area. Mm-hmm. Grand Staircase was a big chunk was in CD2 when I ran, not Bear's Ears in particular, but the amount that it costs for folks for ranchers to graze on the monument land, is at a significant discount compared to what it would be if it were even state or private land. And so it is such an interesting conundrum of misinformation, tensions.
Yeah. I mean, the quote from the president was, quote, you can't go hunting, you can't go fishing, you can't do anything. You can virtually not even walk on it.
Yeah, it's just that's completely, I mean, it's a total lie.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
It's one of those things I just look and I was just going to say, I only want the president to have the powers to designate in an emergency, like for a 6-month period or something, so Congress can go deal with it.
Yeah, like you find something
much more
that
comfortable
needs massive protection because it's
I would feel much more comfortable if Congress is the one in a permanent basis designating the status rather than the whims of any one president one way or the other.
Sure.
And that the president is really just, we found something, it's an emergency, we got to protect it for a certain period until Congress can act.
Yeah, I get it. Let's go to Utah's Capitol Hill now. There's a proposal for what's called the Grand Liberty Arch. Got this incredible sculptor. It's, you know, supposed to be on this lawn adjacent to the Capitol Hill. The Capitol Hill Neighborhood Council was not consulted.
Right.
Felt like there wasn't public input. And, you know, I know this area well. My daughter lives in this area. But you come out these doors and there's, boom, going to be this big arch without consulting with them is the problem I have. Public process matters here.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have a pretty good feel that this is going to be reconsidered.
I think it should be reconsidered. I do think it's good to have public input on these kinds of projects. I think about that those are often imperfect as well. I remember very well the whale when people said, nobody asked us, and there were actually multiple opportunities for the public to weigh in. That is not what happened here. And people do deserve that opportunity.
Yeah.
This gets into, not specifically here, but in the broader sense. Okay, what can people do with their property? And when do you need some type of public process?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there, I've argued
too
often.
You kind of think if
it's
right outside your front door that maybe you'd be consulted with.
Well,
even though you've chose to live by the Capitol.
Basic rules. But, I mean, if my neighbor wants to paint their house purple, I may not like it, but that's their house and they should get to decide that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. All right, you two. I want to also...
Neighbors, don't paint your house purple.
I was going to say, from the land of Prince, I'm kind of into it. But yes, I think there's a difference between your neighbor painting their house purple and the government putting
so
public
funny.
Art
from the land of Prince.
I'm just going to say there's a difference between purple rain and a purple house.
Sure.
Or
I guess
a purple cow.
He did famously have a purple mansion. But the point of the story is that I think there's a difference between public land and private. And that is the distinction here. If you're going to put art in front of somebody home and it is publicly held land, I think they deserve to have some input in it.
Yeah, fair enough. Hey, let's talk about the gas tax. John, I'm looking at you because public finance issues, you've gotten involved in these in the past as an elected official, but our
2003,
state
I said the gas tax is dying. We're going to have alternative fuel vehicles.
Of the state motor fuel tax to help with things. And I don't know that anyone even noticed it.
Well, I think with the price of gas fluctuating so much due to the issues in the Middle East, yeah, I don't think people noticed the 6 cent
yeah,
per gallon
cut. Yeah, and it's from an economic sense that if they hadn't taken it off, they'd be out 6 cents more per gallon than they are. And so that helped with their affordability, but the prices are so much higher than they
were prior. They're swinging so wildly, 6 cents in the noise.
I serve as a transportation commissioner, full disclosure. I'll just say that
she likes to spend those gas tax
dollars. What I was taught is that this cut of the gas tax took away their sort of solutions funding, which is their emergency funding when something goes wrong to go, you know, really direct. Yeah. And I hated to lose that. I think it's some of the most important, transportation money we have.
But one of the key things is just understand long term, the gas tax is dying. Cars are more fuel efficient. We got alternative fuel vehicles. You bypass the taxing mechanism and people want the infrastructure, but a lot of people don't want to pay for it. And that's one of the key things is we have to figure out long term how we're going to pay for our
necessary infrastructure.
Yeah. Shereen, we got the Stopping Border Surges Act. This is Senator Mike Lee. He thinks that migrants are exploiting children to cross our border, and he's got this bill. It's a loophole that Lee wants to fix. Is this a place where you can agree with Senator Lee? Sounds like a loaded question.
It sounds like it, but I would say the devil's in the details with Senator Lee all the time. I do think that there are good reasons to be concerned about what's happening to children at our border. I think I am particularly just still quite disturbed and rageful about the acts that we take to separate children and lose them in systems when they come across borders. I don't know that this does anything to really address kind of the broader, the really complex, problems when we have kids cross borders that may not be with their parents, or the, horrors that are created when we're deporting parents out of homes where children come home and their parents no longer there. So I think for me, this is a small piece of a really broad problem where I'm guessing Mike Lee and I do not agree.
Yeah. Hey, one of the most incredible legacies of our current governor, Governor Cox, will be all of the people he's been able to appoint to the Utah Supreme Court. And he's got
another
big one coming. Yeah. Two vacancies. These are the open seats left by the Chief Justice, Matthew Durant, and Diana Hagan.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like the group, you'll know more about how this works, John, but what's been advanced to him is 6 judges, 3 prosecutors, and 3 lawyers in private practice. It's a dozen finalists. Looks like a good group. Mm-hmm. Got a couple of women in there, 3 women, I think. I'm excited to see what the governor does.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what he does. And one of the challenges with judges or justices is you appoint them and you believe you understand their philosophy, their judicial approach, and that may or may not materialize down the road. And so, you always look in hindsight and say, okay, how did they do relative to what you were expecting?
Yeah. Anything you want to say here, Shereen?
Yeah, I'll just say the reason you point out that it's nice to see some women on this list is that the last list that was advanced had none. So 2 were selected out of the last group, and there wasn't a single woman carried forward for that. And I just think that there is a good reason to have diversity on these, important sort of institutions in our in our state. So I'm hoping that we have a little bit of thought diversity, background diversity, experience diversity, and gender diversity. I think it makes a stronger court.
I think I've worked with 4 or 5 on this list. So
oh, good.
There's some
yeah,
really qualified folks on here.
We just have like maybe about 30 seconds in the program. Any last things you guys want to say to our listeners as the summer winds down, mid-August, hot August heat?
Yeah, I'll just say I've really been enjoying the gold is the new green signs around. And so even though it's been quite tempting, I think, to try to water or make, you know, make lawns greener, seeing people really taking it seriously has been something that I'm proud of that Utahns are doing.
Okay. Water conservation.
Water conservation there. I'm just going to say, stepping back and recognizing folks that disagree with you generally are not evil. You may disagree. You may share actually the same desire and outcome, but there's a different approach of how to get there. And that's where your disagreement is. So you can be friends and disagree. And
I love it.
And my quick word is just keep seeing the bigger picture in life, everyone. And that's a wrap. So good to talk to you, Shireen and John. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.